Coming up next in This Week in Computer Hardware, three awesome PC cases, a faster 780 GPU, AMD price drops, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 232, recorded August 29th, 2013. It's Texture Cache, people.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code Twitch.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most important and most useful and most helpful news in PC and tablet hardware with an occasional gust of console. And yes, cellular phones, if there's something we think is important for everybody out there. That is the laugh of my friend Ryan Shrout, PCPer.com's founder and guiding light. How are you, sir?
I'm doing okay. It's an interesting period in my life because, I don't want to be overly dramatic, September is going to be like massively busy for me. I've got several work trips, huge product announcements and launches and things are going on. So I'm going to enjoy the long weekend this weekend as we go into the holiday. But after that, I won't enjoy weekends anymore, would be my guess.
Till what? Christmas? I was excited. I thought you were about to tell us you were having your first child.
No, not that. That would be much more busy for a much longer time, like 18 years. But
give or take.
I would say I don't know how long it will go. All I know, I barely know my schedule 30 days in advance. I know September is full of it. I imagine that the rest of the year will be full of it as well. So that's good news, obviously. Tech hardware will be busy.
I was going to say, is this your understated way of saying if you're thinking about buying a new PC or GPU, you might want to wait until after September?
Maybe. I think if you're paying attention to the rumors and stuff that are going around, that you have a general idea of what's coming out. What we don't know yet is how good any of it's going to be. Like, you know, Ivy Bridge E is very close. You know that AMD is talking about future generations of graphics stuff. And you know, IDF is right around the corner as well. That's in the middle of September. So you know that they're going to talk about some interesting things there. But what it all means for product recommendations, I no idea, you know.
So with that in mind, let's look at something that probably will not be affected price-wise by the release of a new product. Corsair's Carbide Air 540 case review. We talked about this on the show last week as a possibility.
Are they coming for
you? San Francisco Police Department, not coming for me as far as I know. Because they're going that way.
Good.
In three. Should we cut that and pick it up? Or should we just enjoy the sound of the SFPD at work? Burke?
There you go.
In three, two. Moving on to something that's not going to be impacted by the release of new products anytime soon, as far as we know. Corsair's Carbide Air 540. We talked about this as a case for people that need space. For example, Ryan and I, perhaps the world's worst cable layout people. I actually am almost proud at the point that you cannot see. There is no air in the inside of my Rip Monster 3000 because it is entirely stuffed with cables. And yet somehow this solid mass of cable and hate manages to cool itself off reasonably.
Does this cable act as a heat sink of sorts?
I think at this point, all heat transference from the CPU to the air moving through the case is done by cables.
Nice.
It is not a boutique quality build by any stretch of the imagination. The Corsair Carbide Air, though, the 540, this is an unusual design and a really stylish one. And it's also more of a cube than a traditional mini tower or full-size tower.
Yeah. Do you remember having any cases that were like cube-shaped? I remember we kind of talked about this last night with some of the guys where there was a Lian Li case. It was much, much larger than this Corsair Air 540 that was like – it had four wheels on it, but it was like a complete cube, but it still only held one motherboard and components with it. You just had a ton of space in there for, I don't know, 30 hard drives or whatever it is you needed. This isn't quite that extreme. But you're right. It is a really unique design because it doesn't mount the power supply below the motherboard or above it. It mounts it behind it in a like a separate compartment. And because of that, it's
the box
a
of
much,
shame.
It's a wider case than you would normally expect. That's this, you know, for this style. And it's, you know, Corsair claims that there's a functional reason for it. Right, is that all the components that need a lot of airflow are kind of sequestered into this one unit. Your processor, your motherboard, your graphics card, those are all in that compartment. On the backside is where you keep your power supply, all the cable clutter that you may or may not clean up. And there's also room back there for your optical drives and four 2.5-inch SSD or 2.5-inch hard drive mounts. The biggest caveat to this case, in my opinion, is the fact that there's only room for 2 3.5-inch hard drives. They actually mount on the bottom of the primary compartment of it. And if you're like most users, two hard drives is probably enough. You're either using just one or you're using two in like a RAID array, and then you have an SSD now for your boot drive. And there's room for four SSDs if you want to go that route. But it holds everything, full-size ATX components. It's got room for water cooling on the front, water cooling on the back. It can hold a 7990 graphics card, so it's got room for all the all the biggest and longest GPUs out there.
And all the you could just see the beginnings of the cable snarl all hidden behind the back panel in there. Burke was zeroing in on the cable snarl at the bottom of that picture.
So all the Corsair cases, right? So you can see it's got those little rubber grommets that do a really good job of making things neat. Like you can't help but make a good looking case with most of the Corsair chassis out there. And this one, you definitely want a neat one because the window on the side panel is almost the entire dimensions of the window, or I'm sorry, of the door. So they're going to see everything inside of there. Now, if you scroll down a little bit, Burke, there is a picture of the back and kind of the mess of wires that we created when we actually built a system to take to QuakeCon with us. And the question asker last week was like, hey, usually I only have a little bit of space to try to mash all of my wires into. And is there a way to get around that? And obviously, as you can see this, you have a lot more space. You have more than the width of a power supply of distance between the back of the motherboard and the other side of the door there. So you've got tons of area for that. You know, I always recommend people cleaning it up, but, you know, obviously we didn't. The other gripe there is we're pointing out there, that's the area where the optical drive tray should be. We actually took it out. We weren't using any optical drives, right there should be. You'll notice there's like the 24-pin ATX wire is kind of going into one of those grommeted holes right in the area behind where that tray would be. And that was difficult to access with the optical tray installed. So that's actually why we took it out. So it's kind of like a design issue in my view that it would be very difficult to do that, with that tray installed, let alone if you actually had an optical drive installed in that tray.
Got it.
But yeah, I mean, it's a cool looking design. We saw some comments on the review, people saying this would be really cool if they had turned it 90 degrees and the window was on top, which is an interesting idea. People would say, hey, when are we going to get cases that don't have optical bays in them at all? Right. Because
never.
So few people are using optical bays.
It's funny you mention that because I was admiring another case review that was up on the website, the Leanne Lee PC-A79 full tower, which is up on PCPro.com right now. And it's, Burke, there's the link to that in the show notes that I just dropped in. But, it, you know, it's 2 feet high. It's like 2 feet by 2 feet by 9 inches wide. And it has 12 5.25-inch slot covers on the front. And I was amazed because you start reading through the specs and it can hold 3 3.5-inch hard drives and 2 2.5-inch solid state drives in the cages. Then you can mount an additional 2 2.5-inch drives in the bottom of the case for a total of 9 3.5-inch drives and 8 SSDs. three hard drive cases, which can each hold three and a half inch hard drives. And then I was thinking there, because I'm in the process of converting the Rip Monster from a CD ripper to a Blu-ray ripper. And now I want to see if I can actually get multiple, how many Blu-ray drives in there. And I'm thinking this is the only case I've ever seen that might actually support more 5 1/4 inch drives than the case I already have. But that thing is huge. Is that it?
Yeah. That's a different one. That was actually something we were gonna talk about later. But it's also from Leanne Lee. The final comments I'll say on the Air 540 is that it's $140, so it's not really expensive. It's not a budget case by any stretch.
No.
But considering, you know, it's got pretty decent build quality in there, and it's got some of the Corsair features that you're used to, the giant square opening on the back for changing out the cooler without removing the motherboard. And it does come with three of their higher end air cooled, like low noise, 140 millimeter fans as well. So that's kind of a nice addition. And $140, I think that's within reason. And I do believe that it's also very open for modifications. It's kind of unique shape. May lend itself to users that want to do some more interesting things with the design. I don't know. We'll have to see. We did see several of these at QuakeCon. I think I saw a couple of case mods based on it too. So
pretty cool.
If you want to see the walkthrough, you can just go to pcper.com, and the video that I posted on there kind of goes through our entire build of it, what we liked and what we didn't like, and things to keep an eye out
for. Well, since we're having a festival of cases, I should probably point out that second Leanne Lee case I mentioned, the full tower case, I think is $389, which is a lot of money for a case, even for me, actually, especially for me, since usually building $500 PCs.
Looking at the picture of that compared to what the 540 was, it seems almost out of proportion how tall it is and how skinny it is.
Right. But that's actually a normal old school full tower case. Well, I mean, one more before we go. The PCQ33, it's a prototype of a mini ITX case. And this is one of the areas we've seen some of the most interesting designs for case designs, because, you know, the mini ITX board is smaller than an ATX motherboard. And this cube is 9 by 13 by 10. So it can support 220 millimeter long graphics cards, 200 millimeter long power supplies, 180 millimeter tall CPU coolers. And it looks really nice. Obviously, if you've been listening to the podcast, you know that I'm really excited anytime I see a case without a window in it. So this is a really simple, really attractive design. And if you go to the second, if you kind of scroll down to the second picture on that page, the whole top of the case flips forward, kind of like the front end of a funny car, where it you can basically pull it down and actually have decent access to the inside of the case. Because more often than not, in so many of these case designs, you ended up with this internal cage, which is great for stability, or if you have somebody in your office that likes to stand on your computer. But then you would end up with like these, you know, incredibly annoying bars in between you, and you'd have to sort of pull the PCI Express card sort of up through the top of the cage and then down again and forward. And it was, you know, the pain I'm feeling, and invariably the angle, the angle like aluminum. Yeah. You would have your hands shredded. Now people look at you like, so are you feeling emotionally uncomfortable? Is there anything we can do for you? Like, I was installing a freaking mini ITX motherboard in a freaking tiny case. That one on my desk that you like so much. It hurt me. And then they step away slowly and then realize that you're not insane. You're just dealing with really poorly thought out designs. So
I love this design.
This is a beautiful design.
The unfortunate part that I found out yesterday when I saw this was that it was only a prototype. They're asking enthusiasts to comment on it, right? They don't talk about pricing or release dates or any of that kind of stuff. If you go to that news post at pcper.com, there's actually a link to the extremesystems.org forum post where they're looking for feedback on it. And I wish everybody would say, make it immediately, because
it's awesome. You know,
if it works as well as what it looks like in those screenshots or those images, rather, I would definitely use one of those for a mini ITX billet. I mean, it's just really cool. It's got, you know, here's one with no optical bays as well. Right. It's mini ITX. That's kind of what, you know, you would expect.
It's not that much bigger than a power supply in terms of its actual vertical footprint.
Right.
It
may make it difficult to keep a power supply cabling in there, but You know, this might be one of those instances where getting a modular power supply is actually a requirement because you don't want to keep all those extra.
You can't see the cables, so who cares what they look like? This is genius. This should go into production immediately. Do you have a PR contact at Leanne Lee? Just send them a copy of this podcast. Ryan and I will pre-sign up, kickstart this.
That's right. I'll donate, I don't know, $12. Will that get it done, you think? $12? Yeah.
How many monitors do you have in that room with you? Sell two of those monitors on eBay and you can buy like three of these at full price. Someday you're going to pan to like a wall of 30 monitors. Oh my goodness. MSI GeForce GTX 780 Lightning review. I feel comfortable in saying this is not the fastest graphics card ever, which is not usually what I say when we have a graphics card review.
it is not. That's right.
That's okay, though, because not all of us need to spend $1,000 on a GPU. What's going on with the
How about the, $750, Patrick? Is $750 better than $1,000?
Set of tires for my truck, a month of school for my kid, a significant change.
I just put four new tires on a car, and it was about $700. Mm-hmm. So this is the MSI GTX 780 Lightning. It is a GTX 780 card, as you would guess, which is the same GPU almost that is in the GTX Titan graphics card, but it has a couple more SMX units actually disabled. So it's a little bit lower core count than that. Now, the Lightning series of graphics cards from MSI is famous for being one of those types that is drastically like over-engineered, built for super extreme overclocking, things like LN2, external water blocks, that kind of thing. But they also build in, you know, really high-end kind of custom heat sinks, cooling solutions, power delivery mechanisms on the board itself. And this kind of continues in that trend. So they, like, there are seven heat pipes on this heat sink. There are there's three fans, as you can see, 290 millimeter and an 80 millimeter. The 290 run on one fan controller. The 80 runs on another fan controller, so they can kind of control things independently depending on where areas are getting hot. Heatsink is very dense. They have a great. It's a completely custom PCB. It's not just like a reference card with a new cooler. They designed the board so that it would. It has three independent power controllers, which is one more than a reference design has. They've rerouted where the GPU and memory actually get their power from, so they're not getting a combination of PCI Express bus power and power in from the PCIe power connectors. It's all they're getting it all from the power connectors, so they say that makes it cleaner. The way they kind of loop things around and filter it makes noise or makes power cleaner. All that does is allow them to push the card further in terms of overclocking. I think the default clock speed for GTX 780 is 860 megahertz. I think this one runs at 980 out of the box as its base clock. I was able to overclock it further up to, let's see, 140 megahertz offset. So that takes it up to what, 1120 or so. And then with boost, GPU boost enabled, when we were running our test, we were getting clock speeds up to 1.24 gigahertz. So that's a significant increase over the 860 megahertz, you know, base clock of a GTX 780. It's a great card. It's got this weird bubble on the back that they call the GPU reactor. It's actually just a plastic cover, but underneath there are some capacitors, some really, really high density capacitors that go directly to the back of the GPU, again, trying to provide the cleanest, most reliable power to those areas. So
interesting.
It's definitely an overclockers card. For people that just want to plug a card in and play games, I would say, you know, save the $100 because this is a $750 card. It's a $100 markup over a standard 780. It's a really nice product. If you use the MSI Afterburner software, you can actually adjust three different independent voltage rails, GPU memory, and VRM voltages. You can measure those temperatures directly as well. There are voltage monitoring points on the back of the PCB as well. I mean, there's a ton of features on this part. Out of the box performance at 980 megahertz base clock, it is almost on par with the performance of a GTX Titan, right? So they've overclocked it enough that it's almost on par with that $250 more expensive card. Now, keep in mind that this card has 3 gigs of frame buffer. The Titan has 6 gigs. So that's a sizable jump. If you're going into triple monitor gaming or 4K gaming, that frame buffer size may become, you know, a worthwhile investment, but I'm going to say that 3 gigs is probably good enough for most of those, especially if you're doing like 2560 by 1600, three gigs is fine. When we overclocked it was much faster than a GTX Titan, actually, probably by 10%. So if you look at it from that point of view, it's kind of crazy to think about it, but it's almost a value at that point over buying like a Titan. Instead of spending $1,000, you can spend $750.
As long as you don't want the sort of, you know, resolution future-proofing of the Titan. And the Titan was also really, really built around being super quiet and being relatively, you know, relatively moderate in its power consumption. I mean, either one of these. I was going to say the Titan's pretty close to that, where it's like 150 watts at idle or running in 2D mode. I mean, either one of these cards is going to suck down a lot of power. Compared to say a laptop GPU, but
I mean, it's when it's overclocked, it's definitely using more power than a Titan, because when you push a GPU, its power usage doesn't increase linearly; it increases. I'm blanking on the term all of a sudden, but
geometrically, algorithmically, logarithmically,
there you go. Logarithmically. Thank you. So as voltage increases, when you get up to that max limit, your power draw is going to increase much more dramatically. So, but somebody who's buying a $750 overclocking specific graphics card probably isn't really worried about another 20 or 30 watts of power consumption. So,
yeah, I mean, and we just should also point out, as much as we love saving energy, you are talking about like $4, $6, maybe $8 of electricity a year.
Yeah, I mean, you're not running this thing 24 hours a day. I mean, if you are, then that's awesome. But I wish I could do that. But
you could. You just have to pay a higher electric bill.
Funny side story. Earlier today, I was testing 3 Titans on an unannounced Intel processing platform.
Wow.
As a tease there. And we were using a Corsair 1050-watt power supply. And I had it hooked up to a power meter, and we were looping 3DMark for stability test. And I was looking at it, and I was like, I said, "Hey, Ken, why don't you go to that closet and get me that 1200-watt power supply?" He's like, "What's it reading on the power meter?" I was like, "Well, I hit 975 power draw, and I think that's close enough to the limit that I really want to get to with all this hardware attached. So let's upgrade that."
This could be expensive if it goes sideways.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Is the AMD FX 9595 gigahertz processor getting a price drop? Pile Driver, 4.7 gigahertz, 5 gigahertz turbo socket AM3 plus 8-core processor debuted in June. And this particular online listing is showing it's showing up for under £300, including the value added tax, given that its price started at £699.95. Is this a UK thing? Is this going to happen here? Is this a mistake? Did somebody release it early? I mean, that's
it's
a
not
huge
a mistake. I think the interesting thing about this is it only launched in like the end of June, maybe early July. And I know we talked about it on the show because this is the 220 watt processor that AMD released. It would hit up to 5 gigahertz on turbo frequency, which is kind of, you know, that's a box item mark, right? Oh, I've got a 5 gigahertz processor. If you're one of those people that doesn't really care how much power it draws, that's kind of cool to talk about. But the so what had happened is a couple of UK retailers and e-tailers were selling these for significantly discounted prices. So people started asking AMD, is this a price cut? And their answer was kind of odd in the fact that they claimed that they were not responsible for any of the price reductions on this part selling at retailers, because they never intended this CPU to be sold individually. This was only supposed to be sold as a pre-built system from a custom you know, AMD partner, or as a bundle where you buy a cooler and a motherboard and a processor together. Because their fear was, is people would buy this processor, put it in like a $90 motherboard that doesn't really have the capability to support that kind of amperage through it, and you fry both components. So that was their reasoning behind it. Makes sense. I don't really have a problem with that. But they're kind of, I don't know. They kept using terms like, this is a business-to-business negotiation that's happening, and that's why prices are being lowered. And I was like, well, are we going to see this in the U.S.? Because Burke showed that screenshot at Newegg. The part is still for sale for $879. And that's the bad part for AMD is that when this was tested, they never actually sent us one to test. They didn't send most people one to test. But people who did get a hold of one to actually benchmark found that it was it was near the performance of the top-end Haswell Core i7-4770K processor, which is great for AMD. They've never been that close before. Obviously, you have to ignore the huge performance per watt difference that would be between these two processors, right? The 4770K from Intel is probably using 80 watts, and this AMD part's using 200 watts. So that's a huge dramatic difference there. But if you're an AMD fan, you could probably convince yourself otherwise. But the pricing was always skewed, right? At $800, $900, you were comparing it to a $350 Intel part that is maybe a little bit faster in some areas, also way more efficient, way cooler, doesn't require nearly as expensive of a CPU cooler also. And, you know, it was kind of got bashed on because of that. So I actually think if AMD would own up to this price drop, that they might actually benefit from it, because if you convert that to US, you're talking about $430. Take a little bit off because things are usually a little bit cheaper here than they are in the UK. So you're talking about $375 to $400, right in that wheelhouse with the 4770K from Intel. And now you can make a much better argument for a super high power consumption processor for a consumer, right? For an enthusiast, somebody who's you got to be an AMD fan. You've got to want to have to brag about having a 5 gigahertz, you know, processor sitting inside your system. But this hasn't come to the US yet. I would expect that it will eventually, you know, if you keep an eye out on the bundles and that kind of stuff. I'm curious to see if people like CyberPower and iBuyPower, these kind of little boutique builders, start to sell these systems. You take $600 off of the price, or you know, $500 off of the price of a CPU, and maybe now this is a competitive option for some people against Intel, something that AMD hasn't had in a very, very long time.
Exciting, scary.
Yeah. Just know what you're getting into, I guess, if you go down that path.
Just saying. Windows 8 RTC bug found. Benchmark results still banned at HWBOT. What does this mean that Mr. Very wrote up on PC Per?
You know, it took me a long time to try to figure this out. I'm not 100% sure that I have a grasp on it. So there are internal timers on the processor that keep track of how many ticks are going by in relation to real time. RTC is real time clock. And the operating system and hardware have to agree on these things. And apparently what was happening on Intel systems only, AMD was quick to point out this did not happen on theirs, was if you booted into Windows at a particular base clock speed, not your frequency like 3.6 gigahertz, but like the B clock on a Sandy Bridge, Ivy Bridge, Haswell processor that is default at 100 megahertz, and you boot into Windows at 100 megahertz times 36, and then you downclock the base clock, maybe to like 99, 98, 97, 96, but you keep the multiplier the same, your frequency is actually going down, but the operating system and the hardware aren't communicating correctly, and something gets mixed up. And as a result, benchmarks that are based on how much time has passed will be skewed. And so what happened was, the reason this became a big deal was HWBOT, who was they're kind of like the website that helps facilitate overclocking records and performance records and all this stuff for LN2 guys that are trying to get as much benchmarking in that 6 seconds of time that they have while before they're pulling LN2 on the processor, that there people had found this bug and they were taking advantage of it. And it only happened on Windows 8. It didn't happen on Windows 7. It didn't happen. I don't think it happens on Windows 8.1. I think it's been fixed. So this website, it started banning all Windows 8 submissions for these benchmarks. It's just, you know, and so people came to us and said, does this mean all of your benchmarks for Haswell were incorrect? Invalid. Right. And it's like, no, I mean, you kind of either you have to know about it and maliciously do it, or the motherboard vendor would have to do that. It would be possible for a motherboard vendor to, you know, if you install their overclocking software, to every time you boot up into Windows, you know, push the base clock down 2 or 3 megahertz and, you know, the end user wouldn't notice any difference in performance. You might say, hey, after a week, your clock is off from your watch or your cell phone or something like that on Windows.
I hate that.
But if you happen to have submitted any benchmark scores, that motherboard's products would look better than maybe the competition's by a small amount. So not that big of a deal for most users. You're not submitting overclocking benchmarks and world records, but it was an interesting little drama that happened. But only on Intel processors for whatever reason. I don't know.
Quote, Jeremy Hellstrom on PC Per, as is usually the case, AMD will not comment on the accuracy of DigiTimes information, but as we have seen in the past, DigiTimes roadmaps have been spot on. Over the next 8 months or so, we'll see the arrival of the Hawaii GPU family and the entrance of Kaveri and Kabini chips. Nothing new there, but good to have independent confirmation. In the latter part of 2014 and 2015, things are a little more interesting as Beema will replace Kabini with an HSA-compliant architecture and use a new socket called FS1B. And then in 2015, Beema will be replaced by Nolan, and we will finally see the excavator-based Carrizo, which is, well, probably Carrizo, which is slated to have 45-watt and 65-watt versions. FM1 and AM3 phase out of after production by the end of 2013, with AM3 Plus and FM2 being the two active sockets until FS1B arrives. Any big surprises there? I don't think so.
No, not really. The drama was whether or not it's actually a delay. AMD continues to say that it's not a delay, even though... At CES in January, you know, their executives got up at a press conference and very specifically said that we would have it in Q4. Now we're not going to have it until Q1. Oh, no, that was always the plan. Well, then either you're lying or you're really awful at conveying the plan 8 months ago. One or the other. Neither of them are good.
I would say they're also a little busy right now with the impending launch of a couple of consoles you may have heard of. One of them's called the Xbox One. The other one is called the PlayStation 4. They're probably one of the largest potential sources of revenue at AMD for the next decade or so. So I would imagine anything might be delayed at any point if it will assist in the launch of those two. I mean, I don't know. I just think of the volume of chips they need to drop for those two launches.
Well, the benefit for them there is they're kind of hands off at this point, right? So they said to Sony and Microsoft, here's all the stuff we have. Sony and Microsoft fiddled with it and you know, made changes and did all their own thing. And it's kind of up to them to have the chips made, because AMD doesn't have a foundry anymore, technically. And, you know, they're kind of... they're sitting back hoping the chip is a success, hoping it doesn't overheat and burn up and stuff. And then they'll start to see checks roll in, right? That's the big hope for them is, hey, income would be awesome from this.
We like income. You know who likes income even more than us? The markets. Oh, my God, and our employees. Our sponsors over at ProXPN have some news they want you to know about. There's a new ProXPN app for Android in the Google Play Store that supports OpenVPN. Ryan, you want to explain the joys of VPN from ProXPN to our beloved audience?
I absolutely will do that. So ProXPN, our sponsor for this week, is a global VPN, virtual private network, that works on almost any internet connection. It creates a secure encrypted tunnel for all of your online data. It's any online application will actually work with Pro XP. It doesn't have to be specifically built for it. Web browsing, email, file sharing, IM, all that kind of stuff works. It keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location, giving you unfettered access to websites or online services no matter where you live or you actually are traveling to. I travel a lot, so stuff like this can actually be very useful. Say, for example, I want to watch something on ESPN. But if I'm out of range or if I'm away from my home ISP, it creates some problems sometimes. So using software like this can help alleviate that. They have online privacy through a 512-bit encryption tunnel. It works via OpenVPN or PPTP, your choice there. You can help protect yourself from your ISP's six strikes rules if they happen to have one. Keep your personal internet usage private at work, bypass internet filtering and blocked websites, bypass those geographical restrictions like I was talking about. ProXPN makes your internet connection region free. It has software for Windows and Mac, offers advanced controls allowing you to select which programs and ports you want to route through ProXPN. That also works for your iOS and Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public corporate Wi-Fi with complete privacy on the go. And as you mentioned, there is a new ProXPN app for Android in the Google Play Store that supports OpenVPN, which is nice. They have world-class customer support, and even Steve Gibson gave it a great review on Security Now. So I know you want to try it out, and here's how you have to do it, or how we want you to do it, rather, is to go to proxpn.com/twit. T-W-I-T. For more information, you can sign up there. Premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year, but we have an offer for you. If you use the coupon code TWICH, T-W-I-C-H, you get 20% off for the lifetime of your account. Not 1 month, not one purchase, the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So, the URL is proxpn.com/twit, and the offer code is TWITCH. And we thank ProXPN for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Thank you, ProXPN. TWICH, T-W-I-C-H, at twit.tv is the email address if you want to send us a question. We got just a couple minutes. We're going to try to sneak in two. We got one from Robert about overclocking. So thank you for providing an informative, entertaining show. Thank you for listening, Robert. Says, I'm building a new system and wanted your advice. I enjoy games like Civ 5, but don't play first-person shooters. I need the ability to run VMware and VirtualBox. With my budget, I'm trying to decide between the i5 3570K or the i5 4670. Are the extra features in Haswell worth not being able to overclock, or should I base the build around Ivy Bridge? I appreciate your input, Robert.
Virtualization is not my forte exactly.
Right.
We use it in a couple of areas throughout. But I would say he says he enjoys games like Civ 5, but he doesn't play first person shooters. Both of those processors will run VirtualBox and VMware without a problem. Between the 3570K and the 4670, you know, you really need to think, if you get that K series part, are you going to overclock it? Are you absolutely sure that's what you want to do? You know, right. Both of those are quad core parts without hyper threading. The 3570K, you'll probably be able to bump up to 4.2 gigahertz really easily, maybe right. 4.3 or 4.4. You know, make sure you're not using the stock Intel cooler on it. Any other air cooler or self-contained water cooler will be fine. Mm-hmm. And that could be a fairly significant, you know, 10-15% increase in performance on CPU heavy tasks. And that can definitely be worth it. Now, Haswell itself has an IPC improvement, which is instructions per clock. Basically, if both processors ran at the same clock speed, which processor is faster? Haswell is going to be a little bit faster in that regard, but not on the order of 10-15%, unless right. You're doing like AVX2 really specific instruction set based, you know, like video transcoding, and only a very select few video transcoding apps are actually using mm-hmm. that. You might be able to get an Ivy Bridge motherboard, a Z77 board, cheaper than you can get a Z87 motherboard. So that might mm-hmm. be something to consider as well. I don't have any hesitation telling people if that's the choice you want to make, go ahead and buy an Ivy Bridge part. You know, right. Haswell is definitely better, but the big strength of Haswell was on the mobility side, on laptops And so on the desktops, it's the best, you know, kind of mainstream part, but it's not that much better than what Intel had out previously.
I almost want to say, like, you know, for virtualization, you know, if you want more horsepower, get a Core i7, don't overclock, or mostly throw money at more memory. That always seems to be the tripping point for me is having all the memories available for running virtual machines in. But that also may be because the last time I ran a lot of virtual machines, 4 gigabytes was still considered a lot of memory on a machine.
Yeah.
So,
There are a couple of instances, as somebody reminded me in our chat there, where the K-series parts have a little bit different virtualization tech on it. I'm trying to see exactly what this is. If you go to arc.intel.com, ARK.intel.com, they have a really interesting kind of, you can search for any part and it'll give you information there about what features it specifically has. So I'm looking at like the embedded. It doesn't mention anything specifically. You're going to be able to do it. There might be an acceleration difference there between those two. So it doesn't support hyper-threading, as we talked about. It doesn't support virtualization technology for directed I/O, which is doesn't mean you can't run virtualized devices. And if you're not doing... Right. Like really heavy duty virtualization acceleration type stuff, then it's probably not going to be that big a deal. I mean, it does support the VTX Intel standard and it does do extended page tables and all that kind of stuff that is required for it. There's just a couple of things that they took off of the overclocked parts. So either option is going to be fine. If you know you're going to overclock it, then I would say go that route. If you think that it's possible that you may, you know, buy it, install it, think that you have that opportunity to overclock it, but never actually do it, just go ahead and get the Haswell part because you're going to get that default, you know, IPC improvement, performance improvement out of the gate. And, you know, you don't have to really worry about anything else after that.
Yeah. And I would also take some time. There's a understanding VT-D Intel virtualization technology for directed IO. If you're going to spend a lot of time virtualizing, essentially all the like VTD is disabled in the current K's, and it's basically about direct access to peripheral hardware. And I think you said this, Ryan, but I just want to really overstate it that, you know, if you're thinking about a K processor, do your reading on the virtualization, the VTD, the VTX, and how that's going to impact the tools you are running and how they access things like Ethernet. It could complicate your life. Rich has got a question about frame buffers. He says, I have a question on the use of the term frame buffer in graphics cards. You call the memory on the graphics card a frame buffer. Should it not be called the texture cache like it used to be when 3D cards were first introduced? To me, a frame buffer is a little bit of memory on a graphic card. It has to store the frames it's rendering before sending to the monitor. That's what it was called when graphics cards had 512K to 1 megabyte of memory to handle 1024 by 768. If a modern-day card only had a frame buffer, it would need 24 megabytes of memory or 48 megabytes for double buffering for a 4K display. When 3D cards were introduced, they got more memory for the textures. They did not call it a frame buffer, but the texture cache. Am I missing something, or has the term frame buffer been used for the wrong kind of memory on GPUs? Writes Richard. This is so in your wheelhouse, dude.
I would guess that technically his assertion is correct. That the frame, because you can have multiple frames in buffers if you enable like VSync and you can have 2 or 3 frames buffered. It's called frame buffer by the major GPU manufacturers. It's called frame buffer by the industry. And it has kind of outgrown maybe that nomenclature. But I mean, graphics card memory doesn't sound nearly as cool as frame buffer. If you look it up on Wikipedia, I think it says that frame buffer is a video output device. It actually is. Wow, it's going back to the really old school memory there. It's it's probably an outdated term, but I don't see it going anywhere anytime soon. Once we get to here's the solution for them. Once we get into purely heterogeneous systems where the CPU and the GPU are sharing the same pool of memory, it will not be called a frame buffer anymore. It will just be memory. And he can be happy knowing that the world is corrected,
right.
in that regard. So, I don't know.
Are you correct, sir? Yes. Is anybody in the industry going to know what you're talking about? This is like the whole hacking versus cracking debate. They're not really hackers. They're crackers. It's just, yes, thank you. We'll go talk to AMD and NVIDIA.
it's correct. Whatever. It's fine. It allows me, anytime I can add a new term to how I refer to any one thing, because I write about graphics cards a lot, and sometimes you need to spice up the terminology. So using the word frame buffer versus GPU RAM versus memory and all that kind of stuff makes it easier on everybody. Makes it easier on all of us.
And that's really our goal here at This Week in Computer Hardware, to make your life easier. PCPer.com, marching towards the September of Doom. And man, is there anything you can reveal about what's coming up in the next week, or is it just quiet until September 1st? Which would be next week.
September 1st is like Sunday, right?
I think so. It's all kind of bleeding together at this point. Seamus is starting first grade. We got to review the Garmin HUD up on Techzilla this week, which is really fun. The Garmin's new heads-up display for your dashboard. That was interesting. Huh. I liked it.
Huh. How big is the screen on that?
Small. I'm going to make you watch the video at techzilla.com to see it, though.
we'll have a new processor release. If you've been paying attention, you could probably guess which one that is. IDF is coming up, so that's not next week, but the week after that. And what's interesting about IDF this year is we're kind of in that in between, like they're not ready to talk about a new architecture. They're not going to launch new, mainstream processors. Haswell just launched in March, so they're not going to talk about anything like that. So it'll be interesting to see what angle the company takes going forward with, how much they want to talk about Broadwell and other, complications with that. I imagine we'll hear about things like Ivy Bridge and high performance stuff, which is great because it's been a while since we've really talked about that kind of stuff. So around here, we also have, lots of monitors to talk about again. People keep trying to get this 4K monitor out of my hand, so I'm going to have to do some more work and testing on that before sending it back. Nice. But we'll be busy for sure.
Busy is good.
Yeah.
All right. That's it for this episode of Twitch. This Week in Computer Hardware. You can find more Twitch at twit.com/Twitch. That's easy to remember. TWIC8. Oh.
Twit.tv.
Oh, my goodness.
/Twitch.
It's the children. They're sucking my brain out of my skull. I apologize to the entire Twit audience. Leo Laporte, Burke, and, everyone. Let's try that again.
It's okay. It happens.
If you want to find more Twitch, TWICH, you can find it at twit.tv/Twitch. And you can always email us twitch@twit.tv. Oh my goodness, those addresses get confusing. Mr. Ryan Shrout, are you excited for September or terrified?
Can I be both?
Yes.
I think I'll go with both. And hopefully by the end of it, I'll still be doing the show.
That would be good, because the show would suck without you. That's it for this episode of Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.